Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
If infrastructure is all that enables commerce and prosperity and our economy to function, what could be more fundamental than caregiving? Access to childcare, access to elder care, support for people with disabilities. That is essential infrastructure that we've never, ever invested in, which is why we have all these Black and brown women who are working in jobs where they can't survive, trying to live off of $17,000 a year without healthcare.
The people who are currently doing it are exploited. They're predominantly women of color. Turnover is sky high in this industry because it's so brutally difficult. So what is the plan to transition from the current economy to the caring economy?
Our big vision is something we call universal family care. One day we should have a fund that we all contribute to, that we can all benefit from, that helps us pay for childcare, long-term care, and paid family leave. Basically, everything we need to take care of our families while we're working across the lifespan.
It's like a new version of Social Security.
It is, exactly.
This week on Yang Speaks, we have the incredible founder and visionary and activist, someone I admire so much on so many levels, Aijen Poo. And we're going to be talking about Georgia in part because her organization is getting out voters right now in Georgia as we speak. Thrilled for this conversation.
And in addition, we're going to talk about Yang's potential in the cabinet. You don't want to miss this. Tune in. Andrew, if you were Secretary of Labor, what would you do? And I'll tie that to if someone else is Secretary of Labor, what should they be doing and what can they be doing?
There is so much you can do at the Department of Labor. It's very exciting and fun. And I hope that the next Labor Secretary takes full advantage of our needs and capacities to hopefully help dig us out of this hole. So we are down over 10 million jobs, at least, that we know of. And economists say that 42% of the jobs that we've lost will never return. Now, the Department of Labor spends billions of dollars on education and training programs to try and connect people back to opportunities. Some of those programs are working better than others, but we certainly need much, much more of this. So I would pour fuel on any company, organization, community college that is reconnecting people to jobs and opportunities. I would call it Race to a Million Jobs and just come in and say, look, like, what are you doing? What's that? You hired 500 pipe fitters for these construction sites and projects. What is the actual need for pipe fitters in this environment? And if it's 5,000, then say, wait, what do you need then? Well, you need resources to recruit and enlist and train and outfit. Because a lot of these organizations that I talk to, they're doing great work, but they can't grow to the extent that they want. There's another organization that I love called Kedzie Academy, and they're taking typically high school grads and training them to be engineers and tech employees They're doing it at $20,000 a pop, which is an incredible value because you're seeing a massive surge in income among the folks that go through this program. So I talked to the folks at Kedzie and said, what are your bottlenecks? And they said, look, right now, we actually could be doing much more than we're doing, but people don't know about us. So we actually spend a lot of money on customer acquisition, and we don't have limitless funds. And so the question is, well, if the Department of Labor were to give you a grant of a certain amount of money, could you grow enrollment significantly? Could you train and place more people in the tech industry? And they were like 100% yes. So we should be going around identifying opportunities like this, particularly if they're in communities and community colleges, and then make grants, loans, have prizes, matching grants, have this team of people scouring the country, just trying to help folks who are creating jobs grow. And that would be, to me, job number one.
Let me ask you this. When you were running for president, you ripped apart government retraining programs and things like that. So what is different about Andrew doing this? Is it that you don't have like people to give favors for and like bullshit programs you're funding? Or what makes it more effective in your end?
What you want to do is you don't want to have a fiction that that you yourself can create jobs, unless you just pay people, then, and the government can do that. You know, I mean, that's a role of government. But that's not what we're describing here. What you do is you find an organization or company or school that is already demonstrating success in creating jobs, and you say, look, I'm going to be your growth capital. I'm not going to administer this thing. I essentially become the friendly source of capital that tries to max out your scale as quickly as possible and does it in a way that works for your operation. That's a very different animal than showing up to a group of unemployed factory workers and say, hey, we're going to retrain you, because you don't have any guarantee that there's a job waiting for them at the other end. And those programs have not typically been very successful. You wish that they were. So what you want to do is you don't want to try and create success. You want to find success, and then you want to pour fuel on it. So that's one thing I would do. Another thing would be to establish a future core of young people who are having trouble getting a foothold in the economy, and then connect them to infrastructure, to green jobs, to elder and adult care, to forest care. I mean, we need so many new park rangers if we were going to try and head off these forest fires, to veterans services, to government and public service, and then put them in position where they actually have, let's call it a year of experience in these fields, and then can get connected to a long-term job if they find that it's a fit. There's a massive need on both sides right now, because you have a lot of young people who are dislocated, and you have tons of needs. I would want to invest in vocational training and education, where something I said on the trail all the time is that only 6% of American high school seniors are in any kind of apprenticeship or vocational training. In Germany, that's over 50%. I mean, look at that gulf. So maybe we can't get up to 50%, but can we get up to 15%?
Any progress there is good, right?
Yeah, any progress there would be enormous. You know, I'd want to update the Bureau of Labor Statistics reporting, because right now they don't know what's going on with the gig economy. They don't know what's going on with the green economy or the caregiving economy. They don't have these things actually very well laid out. I've looked at the data, like, you know, they just don't really break it out in that way. The gig economy is a bit of a black box. Like, you know, the studies that are out there are privately commissioned a lot of the time and inconclusive. I would get away from this headline unemployment rate. I would use the U6 rate instead of the U3, which is what we hear of. That includes.
Ooh, could you make the American scorecard as Secretary of Labor?
You know, that's more the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which is under Commerce. But labor could do at least the labor component of it. So you could update the measurements in a way that would, I think, be very powerful and emphasize things like labor force participation rate, which is more telling than the U3 headline unemployment rate in many of these contexts. That would make me very, very happy. One thing that would also make me incredibly happy is trying to enforce actions against folks who are abusing this independent contractor designation. And I understand I've run a business, but the economic incentives to say everyone's an independent contractor is sky high, because then you don't have to pay benefits, you don't have to give them health care. And we know that employers are abusing this. And on one hand, I almost don't blame you because that's where all your incentives are. But on the other hand, you know, we need to start treating people better and having better conversations about like whether someone truly works for your company or if they're truly an independent contractor. So this is the funnest thing in the world, Zach. You know, like some of the highest profile abusers of this designation, Vince McMahon of the WWE and Dana White of the UFC, they call their performers and athletes independent contractors, even though they're controlling all aspects of their behavior in many contexts. Like WWE performers can't even go on Twitch or Cameo, and anytime they breathe the word union, they get fired. That's true of both the WWE and the UFC, and that's illegal. So if you're the Secretary of Labor, you could actually go in and say, wait a minute, how the heck are you controlling every aspect of their behavior if they're an independent contractor? And then if you make them employees, you help them unionize. I mean, that's like a massive game changer. Or an association in MMA's case. For wrestlers, they should definitely have a union or join a union. For MMA, it's a little bit more complicated. I would do everything I can to encourage portable benefits programs that move around independent of work, because that's just the reality of the 21st century economy. I would try to put resources to work to help facilitate interstate migration and lower licensing requirements for everything from hairdressers to medical professionals. I would try and make it, you'll love this one, Zach. This is right up your alley. So there was like a fight over the fiduciary duties of financial advisors, whether they have responsibilities to you as the saver and to disclose fees, not have conflicts of interest, et cetera, et cetera. And believe it or not, the Department of Labor actually put forward this rule because they enforce ERISA, which is the savings and pension plans. And there was a bit of a legal fight as to whether you could have this rule, and we should have this rule. It would save savers $30 billion a year. You know, if you took out all the like the kind of extra fees that financial advisors are slipping in there, and they're often getting kickbacks. I mean, you know, just gotta know that that's happening. Is that close to home for you, Zach?
Very. I always thought you should have, similar to the way that doctors get malpractice, get sued for malpractice, I think financial advisors should have that same responsibility. Particularly, there's the horror stories we would see, and they're not as rare as this sounds, but like the husband dies or the main breadwinner dies, and the lack of spending or insurance or planning leaves the wife and kids or the homemaker and the children with nothing, or mountains of debt without knowing about it, or all these like liabilities and no clue. Like, to me, that's malpractice on the financial advisor's part, because some of the stuff gets so complicated.
It can really screw up lives, you know, and it's certainly costing us billions of dollars. It's making the financial advisory industry richer. But, you know, is that really the purpose? The purpose should be to facilitate retirement savings and the rest of it. I would start a commission on AI and autonomous vehicles to figure out the prospective impact of employment. I mean, and that's not just truck drivers. I mean, Google just announced that they have AI that can do the work of call center workers, and you have 2 million call center workers in the United States. There are massive trends coming down the pike. I would pilot a 4-day work week and have companies sign up for that. And Shake Shack and Microsoft have already experimented with that and then released data. I mean, if you have enough name brand companies operating in a 4-day work week, I mean, that could really start a movement that would benefit us all. There's so many fun things you can do out of labor. It was fun researching this, and hopefully the next Secretary of Labor takes advantage of what the department can do. And I would argue, no matter what, Congress needs to increase the funding to the Department of Labor, because we're in an historic crisis right now. And what is it? It's in large part a jobs crisis. And where should you be putting money? You should be putting money into people's hands, into small businesses, to cities and states. But you should also be putting into the Department of Labor, because if there's an agency that should theoretically be creating jobs and helping, again, pour fuel on efforts that are doing so, it should be the Department of Labor. And having the same budget when you're in a jobs crisis as you do during flush times does not make any sense.
So the only other thing I'll ask is, $15 minimum wage, we get hit on it, or we talk about it a lot. We prefer universal basic income, is more flexible and it's mobile and not tied to the job. But like, for all the workers suffering now for lower pay, is there something you would, like, how would you handle that given, like, if, you know, if your Secretary of Labor, maybe UBI is not getting passed, would you explore a minimum wage or something in that regard?
Well, the tough part is that the Secretary of Labor does not have control over minimum wage regs. It does have control over minimum wage reg enforcement. So you can come down on employers that are, frankly, keeping a lot of hours off books and being like, oh, yeah, we paid you this much. Like, you can enforce that stuff. I certainly am for a higher minimum wage, but that's not something the Labor Department can do itself.
Got it.
Similar for paid family leave, which is something I'm also very passionate about. You can fund things in that direction, but it's primarily something that you'd want to come out of Congress. You could work with companies that are doing it already and try and expand it.
Right. But there you have it. Andrew Yang's thoughts on Secretary of Labor. I think you'd be a fascinating, you're kind of a regulator is what that is. Regulator and lawsuit bringer in chief.
Well, there are two aspects to it. One is trying to enforce the laws on the books. And they're really unenforced in many, many environments. We all know that. You know, it's like, you know that there are all these people abusing independent contractors, like even minimum wage, which seems freaking incredible given how low it is. But then there are other things that the department does, too, that are actually growth oriented, where we spend billions of dollars on programs right now that are meant to try and connect people to the economy. Young people, like there's a program called Youth Build where we take high school dropouts and put them on construction sites to build housing for like low income families. So programs that already exist like that, that we need more of in different segments of the economy, for green jobs, for caring jobs, for tech jobs in particular, because the opportunities in each of those fields are millions of jobs.
I just think it'd be great to have someone thinking outside the box in some of these traditional roles. You know, if you get someone in there that's just going to go status quo, country's on fire. So that won't help. It's just plain and simple. You care where you are, Democrat, Republican, country's on fire, you need to fix it. You need to put fire out.
And one person who's known what people are going through or workers are going through for so long is Ai-Jen Poo. She's the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And, there probably is not a more overlooked group than domestic workers in the country. You know, these are so often women from immigrant communities who are kind of invisible. And Ai-Jen has done amazing work organizing and fighting for national domestic workers for years. She got a MacArthur Genius Grant number of years ago. I know, like, you know, we're all like, whoa, you got a MacArthur Genius Grant.
A bit like you're like, Don, you've been like knighted as a genius if you get that award, generally speaking. There's some I disagree with, but generally it's pretty accurate.
For an activist to get that is a very, very big deal.
And her organization, again, is helping on the ground in Georgia. I've been a fan of Ai-Jen's for a long time. We actually did some work together in like a relief project a little while ago. So here to talk about her work, what we're doing in Georgia, and what the future of labor looks like for a lot of people in this country, Ai-Jen Poo.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and Two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
Hello, welcome everyone. I am thrilled to welcome to the podcast Aijian Poo, who is the senior advisor to Care in Action, which is an advocacy organization for domestic workers around the country, award-winning author, Time 100 alumna, MacArthur Genius Grant award-winning organizer. Aijian, it's so great to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. And thanks for everything you're doing to save our democracy.
Thank you for everything you're doing. So people who've been keeping up with us know that I'm here in Georgia. You can tell by the peach. And we're trying to support organizations who are doing work on the ground, who've been getting out the vote this whole time. And Care in Action is one of those organizations where you all have been organizing workers and voters here in Georgia.
That's right. Actually, the domestic workers movement has a really long history and deep roots in Georgia, dating all the way back to 1881, when the first washerwomen, Black women, went on strike to raise wages and won wage increases for thousands of workers, to the 1970s, when the incredible civil rights leader Dorothy Bolden founded the National Domestic Workers Union. And by the way, when she founded the Domestic Workers Union, she had the only two requirements for joining were that you had to be a domestic worker and you had to be registered to vote. So civic engagement and voting rights and voter participation has always been in kind of the DNA of our movement. And we've been building really intentionally there as a movement since 2013, focused on organizing Black domestic workers who are working incredibly hard and still not able to make ends meet, still don't have access to a safety net or job security or even a single paid sick day. And we've been organizing to try to improve conditions. And in 2018, we got deeply involved in building the power of women of color voters like domestic workers in our democracy and to shape the future of Georgia. And we were so proud to be one of the largest field operations in support of Stacey Abrams' historic campaign for governor.
Yes.
And we focused on hard-to-reach women of color voters who are considered so-called low-propensity voters. We see them as high-potential, high-value voters who can really transform our electorate to be much more reflective of who we are as a country.
So for people who are thinking, wow, so glad Georgia went blue, you have Care in Action to thank because they've been working on it for 7 years. You know what I mean? Like, this stuff does not happen overnight.
Well, that is true, but I have to say that Black women really led the way in Georgia and have always really led the way in Georgia. And we
not your organization exclusively, but that there have been people like you working on it, like Stacey Abrams. Other orgs. So this stuff does not happen quickly or magically. It happens because people have been in communities doing the work this whole time. So I'm a huge admirer of yours, in large part because of your origin story. So I just wanted to geek out a little bit, because you and I have a lot in common. I don't know if you know how much we have in common. So check it out. I'm the child of Taiwanese American immigrants. My dad had a PhD in physics. My mom had a master's in math. They came here. There was this period in the 60s when the U.S. was letting in Taiwanese grad students. And so they came here, they met each other, and then they had me and my brother in the 70s. I think you and I might even have been born the same year. And then I went to Phillips Exeter and graduated in 92. And then I wound up going to Columbia for law school, where you went undergrad. So the thing that blows my mind about you, Aijian, is that you and I think, you know, have those things in common. I think pretty much everything I just stated, like, it could have been you talking. But then you did something that was so unusual, certainly for our community, really for anyone, because, you know, there aren't many people like you. So you have this education that primes you for doing, frankly, you know, like what a lot of our peers did out of a place like Columbia, which would be medicine, finance, consulting, business, tech, in my case, law, and the rest of it. But then you took a very, very sharp detour and became a labor organizer. So I would love to hear how the heck that happened.
Wow, I had no idea we had that many experiences in common. That's incredible. Thank you for naming all of that. We have lots to talk about. But in terms of how I became a labor organizer, when I was in college at Columbia, one of the reasons why I wanted to go to Columbia was it was in New York City. And the city and its energy and its diversity in communities and the size of the Asian immigrant community in New York were some of the reasons why I wanted to be there. And I started volunteering at a domestic violence shelter for Asian immigrant women. And I could still speak Mandarin, so it was actually a value in terms of being a bilingual hotline volunteer. And a lot of the calls were not just about the struggles of surviving violence or abuse, but a lot of them were about how hard it was to just survive as a mom, as someone working in a low-wage service job. You know, I would hear from women who were domestic violence survivors who were working in nail salons or doing domestic work and long, long hours and still not able to pay the rent or, you know, cover the expenses related to school for kids. And I just remember thinking, like, how could it be that there's so many people who work so hard and do everything right and survive so much and still can't make a decent living and take care of the people they love? And that kind of led me down a path of trying to figure out how we make work better for women, especially women in our communities, women of color, women who are really struggling at the bottom of the economy where we just don't value so much work that's actually essential.
There are a lot of people who, frankly, volunteer at nonprofits when they're in college. But then they don't make a career out of it in the same way that you have. So like the thing that, again, I just want, because I'm genuinely curious, I think you can tell, is so you're an undergrad, you're volunteering downtown. And then like, how are you spending your summers? Like, and what is your first job when you graduate from school? And also, like, how is your family taking this in? But I'd love to start really like with what your college career looked like and then what your first job was.
Yeah. So in college, I volunteered at the New York Asian Women's Shelter and then also at the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence, as you mentioned, where we started the Women Workers Project that led to lots of the other work to organize domestic workers. And then I also on campus was involved in a campaign in 1996 to win ethnic studies on campus at Columbia. So in the spring of 1996, there was kind of a multiracial coalition of students who came together to fight for an ethnic studies department. And the combination of the volunteering on campus or the volunteering outside of campus in the community and the work to try to change how things worked on campus and working across race, it was really transformative to me. Like the fact that we actually waged a campaign, we took over buildings, we went on hunger strike, we did all kinds of stuff, and we won. There's now a Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia because of the activism that we did. And I think I got kind of addicted to winning. Like, I just got really excited about the fact that
you're
could actually...
I'm one for one. What else could I do?
Yeah. I kind of was like, hey, you could get just like regular people together, get together and fight for something and make some real change that can affect future generations. And I think I kind of caught the bug, but I didn't know that you could make it a career, to be honest, Andrew.
Yeah, like,
I
was exactly. Like,
yeah, no, there was no, I did not think of it as a career. I thought maybe I would be a writer. I was tutoring at the Borough of Manhattan Community College as a, you know, in the summers and then after I graduated to help people prepare for the writing assessment test. I thought I would like get some kind of a job to pay the bills while I wrote.
In publishing or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I also worked in restaurants. I was waited tables and I worked as a bartender. And I
was a busboy at a Chinese restaurant in upstate New York, the Imperial Walk.
Were you really?
Yeah.
I was. How old were you? When did you do that?
I was in my teens. My Chinese was too shoddy for me to translate orders, so I couldn't be a waiter. I was like, in some ways, because that's what you had to do to get the orders to the kitchen. You had to like, you know, write in Chinese because the cooks don't speak English. We had that experience in common too. It sounds like it sounds like you were further up the server food chain than I was, because your Chinese sounds like it's better.
Well, I think my grandparents raised me, so they taught me Mandarin as my first language, but you know, when you're mainly a child learning a language, so I feel like I have like a 10-year-old's level of vocabulary.
I don't know if people know this about me, Ai-jen, but I got left back in Chinese school over and over again. So like the folks, ooh, like the kids next to me were just like like I was getting bigger and bigger. Like the class always staying the same size, like this overgrown third grader. That Chinese school.
I had a similar experience in Taiwan, because when I went and spent summers in Taiwan with my grandparents, they sent me to school because the school year lasts much longer in Taiwan. And so I was a giant second grader in a kindergarten class, and like,
what?
Kids wet their pants during nap time. And I was so embarrassed to be like a huge kid with all these so-called babies. And yeah.
So, I mean, so that sounds like some tiger parent. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't, they just wanted to see family, but it's like, this American school, you're not long enough. Let's like bring you back to Taiwan and just like plant you locally and just keep that school year going. That's some funny stuff. Yeah. I mean, I didn't even know you could do that. How many summers did you have this extended school experience? Was it just second grade, or did it happen later too?
No, I spent every summer of my childhood, I think, until maybe fourth grade in Taiwan with my grandparents.
Wow. Well, you must have been very close to them. That's beautiful.
Yes. Yes. Very, very close. And my grandmother in particular is like my hero. She just passed away recently, actually.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My grandmother as well.
Really? Did Taiwan. You lose your grandmother? Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Last year while I was running for president, my grandmother passed. So we had that in common too. No, it's fine. My family was sad for a bit. I was more concerned about my mom. My children didn't really, my older son had met her once. So it's not like they were close to her.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech, who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang.
So let's fast forward again to when you were coming out of college. So you're waiting tables, you're doing various things, you're a bartender. How did you figure out that activism was an actual career choice after you'd had this massive victory your senior spring?
I didn't really know that it was. When I was volunteering at CAV and we started the Women Workers Project, the Committee Against Anti-Asian Violence, we started the Women Workers Project as kind of an all-volunteer committee to do outreach to women working in different low-wage service jobs and to try to organize for better conditions. And we were all volunteer. And then we realized that we needed somebody full-time who would get up every day and really be thinking about how to move this work forward and follow through and keep in touch with the workers we were meeting. And we put together a job description. We applied for some grant money to fund the position. And I really didn't think that I would do that. But when nobody applied for the job, everyone in the volunteer committee convinced me to do it. So I started out doing it part-time for a while, and then it became full-time. And I think what I'll say is that even then, I didn't think of it as my life's path. I followed the women that I met and organized with along the way and was so moved by the incredible courage and resilience of the women that I would meet in the work. And I just kind of took their lead and kept going. And we would win along the way. And that also kept me going.
Wow. So you're tutoring, you're bartending, and then you're volunteering, and then the volunteerism gets to a point where it's like, hey, someone should actually start doing this like part-time. So do you remember who the original grantors were to fund this part-time and then full-time position?
I think the New York Women's Foundation and the Ms. Foundation, maybe. The North Star Fund.
It was a while ago, obviously.
Some of the grassroots social justice foundations in New York City. Really important early supporters for seed projects like that.
So yeah. Listen to this, philanthropists and funders, you end up funding these positions, and then sometimes they end up mushrooming into these world-changing activists. Doesn't happen. You know, if you don't fund it, who knows? Maybe iGen is doing something else right now. you never know. So philanthropists, you got to get in there early. So you're working eventually a full-time role for CAV. And then you wound up transitioning into starting your own or organizing really domestic workers and starting an organization to that effect. What is that arc like? Because, I can see the volunteer. I can see, okay, no one else wants to do it. So everyone's like, iGen, you do it. And one of the things that happens in these environments, it's a little bit like a school project where responsibility ends up falling on whoever the most competent person is. You know what I mean? Like if you have like a class project and there are five of you and then there's one person who's on top of it and the other four, you know, not as good. So that everyone's like, ooh, person who's on top of it. So I can imagine that happening, and I can imagine, you doing it full time. But then there was like this entire arc where you go from part-time to full-time to actually starting your own organization, which is a very, very big deal. And this, I'd imagine, happened, this arc transpired, it seems like, throughout your 20s.
Mm. Well, one thing that your listeners should really know is that none of these things are because of singular individuals or processes. And at least in my experience, I've been organizing for 25 years, and it has always been a collective effort. And maybe my name is on paper as the staff person or as the executive director or as a co-founder, but it takes groups of us, squads. It's always a squad effort, I find. And I'm sure you found this too with your campaign, Andrew. It's like, it took like, there was just like an essential core group every time to really take the work to the next level. And that's really, I think, the story of the domestic workers movement that I've been a part of it was like a group of Filipino domestic workers who decided to take the project multiracial, and then a group of Caribbean women who decided to really expand, strengthen the work in New York City together with Filipinas and South Asian women and Latina workers. And then a group of New York workers then get together with a group of workers from LA, DC, Seattle, San Francisco, and then we launched the National Alliance. We had 50 co-founders of the National Alliance in 2007. And then a group of us, you know, in the domestic workers movement after the 2016 elections, you know, a bunch of domestic workers said, we need an advocacy platform. We have to be able to use every tool at our disposal to make this democracy, to save our democracy and to make it work for us. And so that's how Care in Action was formed. And it was never, ever me. I'm often the fundraiser, to be honest. But there's so much leadership and so much collective leadership behind every effort and every breakthrough. And so many of the people who made this moment in the movement possible, they're names that you'll never hear of, but who were absolutely essential to the work.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
So servant leaders like yourself, so you get to an organization or a group of people and you see the need. I mean, the need you're trying to address is obviously monumental, like the mistreatment of and systematic marginalization of domestic workers. I mean, you knew like it's very, very pervasive. It's like, you know, it's political, it's economic, it's human, like it's everything. So you get, and I can relate to some of these experiences, and I would never put myself anywhere near you in terms of activism, but I did start a nonprofit, and one of the things that happens when you start a nonprofit, if you are, like, let's call it like the founder, the co-founder, whatever it happens to be, it really does translate to fundraiser in chief, you know what I mean? And like, like your job is to raise that money. When I started this nonprofit, I thought the idea for the nonprofit spoke for itself. And no one needed to hear about Andrew Yang so much. But then someone that worked with me at the nonprofit said, Andrew, in order for the organization to raise money like this, like Andrew Yang needs to be this or higher. Like you need to see anything that accrues to you as good for the organization. And if no one knows who you are, cares about you, the organization is not actually going to succeed. And this is someone who was working with me at the organization. I really needed that boost. Thank you, Mike Tarullo, for saying this to me. But I needed that boost to be like, okay, so like, I guess it's okay if I show up to these conferences and sit on a panel or show up to stuff and try and interject myself or elevate my own profile because it makes me a more effective fundraiser. And the fact is, if you're serious about trying to start an organization or raise money, that stuff's very, very useful. So that was like a very big shift for me because you don't want it to be about you. You want it to be about the work and the folks who are actually doing the work very often. But the reality of raising money is like, you know, it's very helpful for people to actually think, oh yeah, I saw that person at that conference. Or in your case, you've won like every award in the book. and there's part of you, I'm sure, that's like, who cares about the awards? But then, but you know, the awards end up opening doors for you so that, you know, what started out as a meeting with like a funder at this level, like eventually becomes a meeting at this level.
Yeah. No, it's a really interesting thing because I don't think any of us get into this work to be on panels or go on TV, or, you know,
or that's even really funny. My even, dream is to be on a panel at some social innovation conference,
you know, and I'm an introvert. So the idea of going on MSNBC is like horrifying for me. but, you know, you do it in the service of the work and then you do realize that that visibility is really important, not for you, but for the work and the goals of your work. And but it's still kind of conflicted. And I remember when I learned that I was going to be a recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship.
The Genius Award, for anyone who doesn't know. Anyway, continue.
My first reaction was like, this is not right. You know, I'm a part of a movement, and to single me out, if there's any genius here, it's in the collective. And so, you know, I remember feeling really conflicted and weird and exposed. And I think where I've come is that, you know, if you're using your platform in the service of good, that in some ways you're leaving power on the table by not, you know, taking up that space.
Especially for someone like you now, it's like, you know, like you now have the ability to access platforms and resources that would be immensely helpful for the movement in a way that, frankly, it's like very, very tough for someone else to do that hasn't built that up over time.
Yeah.
But I actually have this in common with you too, Ijen, is that I also am an introvert.
And are you really?
Yeah. I got tested and the rest of it. But also I know for myself, you know, my favorite thing to do is to read. Like I was a very bookwormy kid. And running for office is certainly like the opposite of that activity. And, you know, like for me, the campaign was about this set of ideas that I wanted to put out there. And I was always like, look, like if we get something like universal basic income passed and everyone just forgets about Andrew Yang, I would be thrilled. Like you can, you know, and it's one of the things that's weird about me is that, it's like you where it's like, I see it as a tool. Like, and I've got like tools to try and reach goals and like make positive things happen, but I really don't care about what many people would regard as like that, you know, the trappings of a public life or whatnot. That if you just like left me alone to like chill out with the family and like read books and maybe write some stuff. I mean, I do enjoy writing too. So, you know, it's helpful too on that side. It's like, there are many awesome writers who have a hard time getting book deals because like they don't have public profiles, which, right. You know, is that correct or accurate? It's like, well, you know, it stinks. And I can very well see myself as one of those people, because I was the awkward, introverted, Asian kid growing up. And most people I don't know, like regard me as that now, because at this point now I've got like this, different set of public-facing tools, I guess, where when you talk about cringing at the idea of going on MSNBC, it's like I actually pop up on TV kind of on the regular now, because it's sort of like,
I've noticed,
something I signed up for, which also, let me say, was freaking shocking to me, because going on those cable news hits was one of my least favorite aspects of campaigning. Mm-hmm. I was genuinely stunned when CNN called me like the day after I dropped out and was like, hey, you want to come on TV? And like, I was like, really? Anyway, so there's a very long-winded way of saying, I think you and I have the introversion thing in common. So I understand like how you have to push through it all the time.
Mm-hmm. No, that's right. And I imagine in your campaign, you had to push through a lot of different kinds of, I mean, I can't think of a more extroverted experience than running for president of the United States, to be honest. I'm curious, how did you regenerate your energy through the campaign?
Afterwards?
Or even during, like, how did you, because I know for me, if I'm having a very externally oriented day, like a lot of public speaking or events or something, I really need the time afterwards to just kind of be quiet and do my yoga or whatever. What do you do?
Well, I think my team understood me where like I would go give a town hall and be like, yeah, and we're going to like do this and, you know, humanize the economy and like, let's change the world. And I get back in the car and then all of a sudden it'd be like, you know, like leave me alone. Like my team would just like, let me,
that's great.
Yeah. Like let me, and in some cases the way I would recharge would be like, you know, I might, sit there and silently read something. You know, I might read something that would be frankly unrelated to politics. Like I might like read a sports article or something like that. Like that might be a way that I could recharge mm-hmm. between events even, because in many cases, the car would stop and I'd have another event and then someone would go to my ear and say like, okay, this is the town you're in. this is the person who's introducing you. Like, yeah, they're kind of like variables that I would need. It wasn't easy, iGen, though. Like, it became, it was wild in that I pushed myself further than I had ever had to before. And I started running in like late 2017, but no one paid any attention. Mm-hmm. And then the spotlight was very bright in late 2019, early 2020. Mm-hmm. So I had to develop adaptations I never thought I would. I consider myself very self-sufficient. I like doing my own thing more so than having a group of people around me, like a coterie or attendants or staff or whatever. But then down the stretch and the campaign, I had like a giant retinue and like doing everything. And it was like so uncomfortable, but it just mm-hmm. made a lot more sense. Just like a basic thing where like I would get to a hotel room and like the hotel room had been like advanced, which means like my luggage was there and the rest of it. Like, you know, I'd spent like a year and a half just like hauling my own luggage and doing this and that. And then all of a sudden like you get there and it's like some genie came in and like, you know, put the room together. And, you know, there's a period where you're like, well, this sucks. But then like there's a period also where it's like, well, I guess this is like how we have to function if I'm going to, you know, do five of these town halls like tomorrow and not have to think about certain things. So it really was what you're describing, like those extroversion days taken to the extreme, like mm-hmm. ramped up to 11 or 12, like past any sane limit, honestly. But I had the goal in mind the whole time was like, I have a chance to potentially accelerate the end of poverty. Like, so there was like never, you know, it's like you'd get up and just be like, just do whatever must be done, because I felt like there was an opportunity that I might never see again. And like, I already felt like there were so many people who'd invested their hopes and aspirations for a better life in what we were doing. So I felt all of this energy, responsibility, opportunity. And then when the campaign ended, it was a little bit like I'd been running on this incredible kind of crowdsourced energy that then that then left me. And mm-hmm. I didn't leave me in the sense that, you know, people still seem to, you know, like me and whatnot, which I appreciate. Thank you, Yang Yang. Love you. But you know, it was a very big change. And then the downshift was so weird, you know, like, because you were more extroverted than you ever had to be. And then I kind of had this strange transition into like being on TV sometimes, but not all the time. Like I didn't have the same campaign team around me all the time. I was a public figure for the first time, so if I just walked around the streets of New York, people would be like, "Hey, Andrew Yang," and I was like, "Well, like hey. This is new and weird."
Yeah, totally.
like this is
and
strange.
A lot of responsibility too as the first API candidate to reach the kind of momentum that you had. I mean, I'm sure that must have been challenging in terms of the expectations.
Well, one thing I haven't talked about a lot, iGen, but I've been reflecting on a little bit more, is that I think as an Asian American man or boy, you know, in the past or whatnot, I genuinely thought I had this kind of invisibility cloak that I could put on anytime I wanted, where if you like walk into a deli or a restaurant, like no one pays much attention to you if like you're not really trying to be, you know, generating attention. And so I was so used to that anonymity that I think frankly was like ramped up by being Asian. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. like I think, you know, maybe everyone thinks they can just blend into the woodwork, but I certainly mm-hmm. felt that to like, I think a slightly higher degree, because I just don't think people pay that much attention to Asians when you were mm-hmm. like walking around. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the first time someone recognized me when I was not wearing anything related to the campaign, where I just had like, you know, sweats and a hoodie on, And someone was like, hey, Andrew Yang. I was like, you know who I am? Like, the whole thing just discombobulated me so much. And then even after it happened, I was like, yeah, that person must have been weird. So the visibility was something that I never anticipated. It's funny, I ran for president and still never expected that to happen, which is very odd given that, you know, you presume if you're going to be at least somewhat successful, like that might happen, but I genuinely never expected it to, and was confused by the adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember thinking, as a fellow Asian American, I remember thinking, what an incredible responsibility, and wow, do you have a, I remember wondering, like, do you have a kitchen cabinet of other AAPI leaders who you could consult on how to navigate it all? Because having to do that alone must have been really challenging. And I remember, I'll just be totally honest, like some of the calls you would make around like leaning into the math thing or talking about being more American and raising, you know, wearing flags and things like that. I just remember being like, oh no, you know, like let's not reinforce stereotypes that could be really challenging. But then I also understood that there was a really important need for you to claim your identity in a way that was authentic to you, and the responsibility of having to then think about representation of all of us in this role of you trying to just lead, is one that's just fundamentally unfair and a reflection of white supremacy itself.
That certainly lets me off the hook for a lot of things.
Well, no, I'm not letting you off the hook here. I'm just saying, like, I know enough about how anti-Asian racism works that I know that you were in a really tough spot. And so, yeah, there were many moments I wish I could have like called you up on the bat phone and been like, hey, Andrew, no, let's not do this.
Well, you know, what's funny, Ijed, is that you somehow would have had to make those calls like before the fact. And I probably didn't even know I was going to do it before the fact. So it would have been to try to insulate me from some decision I was going to make, you know, 5 minutes later.
Can I say one thing, though, before you continue, which is that I think that it was also amazing to watch you become like as an organizer, right? As you like, I watched your campaign early and then how it evolved, and you became like a better and better campaigner like every day. You got sharper, you got stronger, you were just like, and it was kind of amazing to watch. When like you and your wife came out about autism and your experience with your child, like that was so important and could have easily not happened. And so I just think it was also very historic. And so even if I had some disagreements along the way, I was also like, go, along the way as well.
And this is before you knew that you and I had so much in common.
That's right. Exactly.
Well, I certainly appreciate it. And I genuinely feel like your arc and mine have been similar. And I'm really inspired by you because I feel like, what I've gone through over this last period of time, you've been in it for, you said 25 years. And you started in a line of work. I guess I'll return to something I was curious about earlier, which is like, what did your parents think about the fact that their daughter, has been fighting for domestic workers' rights for this period of time? I mean, I assume now it's probably different than when you were in your 20s getting started.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, it's different now. I was really lucky that my parents were very understanding, and my mother.
Do you have siblings?
I have a younger sister. Yeah, she's a filmmaker in Los Angeles. She's awesome.
Wow.
Neither of us went into science or medicine. And my parents were really supportive of us throughout. I think wrapping their heads around how I was going to make a living was like a question. But
like that work pays? Like question mark.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like that's a job. But I think, and also what the job was, like, what is a community organizer? What is, you know, but I think that they knew they're both very caring individuals and justice minded. And I think that they liked the fact that I was pursuing something that I was really passionate about. And both of them did the same. And they're both incredibly passionate about their work and committed to it as like some real driving force, higher purpose. And I think they were glad that I found that for myself, even if they had questions about livelihood issues along the way.
I feel like you and your sister could have a competition. It's like, which of us chose a more financially impractical career path? And then your sister's like, what's that? You're a community organizer? I'm going to go you one better. Independent filmmaker. Like, maybe you gave her cover with your parents where she was like, well, I mean, heck, look at iGen. Like, they can't be too bad if I become a like a creative.
Yeah, no. Were your parents supportive of you?
I mean, they were sad when I left the law because I had a secure professional career and my parents were very happy about that. And then when I left to become an entrepreneur and a failed entrepreneur at that, and that was not easy for them. And then it became very confusing to them. I was always working on various startups to frankly low degrees of success for a number of years. And so they were pretty sad about that. They became enthusiastic about my political run only after the fact. Like when I broached it to them, they were not pumped about it, which was probably fairly sane of them. And then later they became my biggest boosters. In the scheme of parents and Asian parents in particular, my parents have been awesome. You know, that there was never any attempt to try and change my decision or path. There was certain levels of concern.
Exactly.
But there was never like, you're making a mistake and, you know, I'm going to try and like drive you to do this and not this. One of the things I said when I left the law, I was like, look, I'm not going to ask you for a dime. So don't worry about it. It's my decision. And like, I'll handle the responsibility. Like the consequences will be mine and not yours. Maybe you can't brag about me to your friends anymore, but you know, you'll survive. was what I said to them. Which maybe was a little obnoxious, but in the scheme of things, my parents have been tremendous, and we've always had a very loving and communicative relationship, even if they weren't thrilled with my choices.
Yeah, that's great. We're both very lucky.
One of the things I want to try and unpack is the scale of the mistreatment of domestic workers. And so here's the thing that happens. All right. So we all know I'm running around being like, hey, AI automation technology, it's going to like decimate, you know, a lot of the most common jobs in the economy. And then a lot of people say, and this is dumb, I'm just saying this is the straw man, but I just want to explain how dumb it is. But people will be like, it's okay, because then we will have like a caring economy and everyone will just like look out for each other and take care of the elderly and all will be human and glorious. And then I say, okay, I love that vision and I'm all for that vision, but the people who are currently doing that work now are underpaid, exploited, really high turnover. It's both emotionally and physically injurious. And sometimes I share a story where I was like a home healthcare aide for 15 minutes or so, where there was like an elderly person and we needed to like move them across the room. And I was just enlisted to help. And I was like, sure, you know, I'm like able-bodied person. Let's do this thing. And then we like moved the elderly gentleman across the room and my back hurt. Like immediately thereafter, it's like I moved this person. I'd been doing it for all of 15 minutes. So when I say to the people who are positing this caring economy, it's like, hey, FYI, the people who are currently doing it are exploited. They're predominantly women of color. Turnover is sky high in this industry because it's so brutally difficult. So what is the plan to transition from the current economy to the caring economy that does not involve a massive transferal of tens of billions of dollars a year? Like, you know, that's like the question I pose them. It's frustrating to me because people just like traffic in abstraction so much. It's like, do you believe in the caring economy? Like, yeah, we all believe in it. It's like, are you willing to invest in it in like a real way? Are you willing to treat the people who are currently doing it like at a certain level where they can actually live like sustainable lives and not be exploited left and right? You know, or it's like the folks who are like taking care of our grandparents, like don't have healthcare themselves. It's like, does that make sense to anyone? Like, we're just going to like rely upon this totally. Class of people that we're just going to pretend doesn't exist.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I'm so glad you brought this up because we actually do have a plan. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris announced a 21st century caregiving plan to invest in the care economy for the 21st century as part of its economic agenda. And it's the first time, really, that a presidential campaign made investments in the care economy a core part of its economic agenda. Not the women's agenda, not the work-family balance agenda, the economic agenda, because of the understanding of its fundamental nature in our economy and the need to invest in it like infrastructure, right? We think about infrastructure.
It's like a human infrastructure. Please.
It's a human infrastructure. It's like if infrastructure is all that enables commerce and prosperity and our economy to function, what could be more fundamental than caregiving? Access to childcare, access to elder care, support for people with disabilities. That is essential infrastructure that we've never, ever invested in, which is why we have all these Black and brown women who are working in jobs where they can't survive, trying to live off of $17,000 a year without healthcare. And so there is actually a plan that the president-elect announced during his campaign to make caregiving jobs, living wage jobs with benefits and a union, and to expand access to childcare and long-term services in the home and the community, really big deal. But I also want to say that this is actually just a step. Like,
doesn't do the trick. I mean, it'd be a tremendous
that's
step
right.
forward.
But it would be a huge game changer. I mean, oh my God. But our big vision is something we call universal family care. I don't know if I've ever shared this idea with you, Andrew, but the idea is that one day we should have a fund that we all contribute to, that we can all benefit from, that helps us pay for childcare, long-term care, and paid family leave. Basically, everything we need to take care of our families while we're working across the lifespan.
It's like a new version of Social Security.
It is, exactly. And it is the perfect thing for social insurance because social insurance works best when there's a really large risk pool. This would be the largest pool in history because it would be all of us. We all need care. And it would make care so much more affordable. And we could actually innovate and make the jobs better. And we could do so much because we would be investing in our caregiving systems as infrastructure for the 21st century. So that's what
I love this so much. So this is the Universal Family Care Fund. Is that like the name?
We just call it Universal Family Care.
Universal Family Care. I am on board, which is probably shocking
Yay!
To nobody. Oh, really? Because I've obviously been saying we need to humanize the economy and put money into people's hands so we can do what we need. And the caregiving economy gets ignored by the market economy a whole lot of the time.
That's right.
And so what's been happening for years is just there are these folks who've been doing it because, you know, of a variety of reasons, but it's getting worse and worse for them. You know, and like you can see it in some of like the most basic things. I have a perspective on this that, you know, others may not agree with, but you can see it very clearly in the fact that just people are having fewer kids. You know, you look up and be like, hey, guess what? Like, you know, we're in this like punitive economy where everyone's just having to grind out like, you know, subsistence living. And so people are like, well, you know, you can't have kids under these circumstances. And so you have just like fewer people making that move. And then if you do have kids, then it turns out the resources aren't there. You know, like when you get there and you're like, wait, what does daycare cost? What's going on?
Well, then you have COVID where... And I actually want to talk to you about COVID and automation because I'm curious on your take on it, if COVID's going to accelerate the worst aspects of automation.
Oh, yeah. Already done.
Right? That's what I've been afraid of. But
10 years, you know, and 10 weeks is what I've been saying, iGen. We've gone through 10 years and 10 weeks. This took the timeline and just like accelerated it very, very quickly. And half of companies came out and said, we're investing more in automation because it just makes business sense. So you're seeing a lot of companies that were on the border just committing. You know, like Sam's Club came out and said all of their locations will be cleaned by robots. Tyson Foods said that they're going to replace meatpacking workers with robots. Google said that they have AI that can do the work of call center workers. That would have happened anyway. That probably is COVID independent. But the other two things were COVID related.
Well, the thing also that my economist friend Larry Katz at Harvard explained to me is that automation has always been a part of our lives, right? Always. But the resilience that we've seen in our economy has to do with the length of time that we have to actually see
how some tech advances create
new jobs that you can't foresee, right? And so that some technological advances do create new jobs, right? But that happens through time. And when you have an accelerated time frame for automation, like what happened with COVID, there's not enough time for the resilience piece to work itself out.
Yes. It makes me very, very concerned and scared, honestly. It's like I have a sense as to what COVID has done to workers. It's been catastrophic. And our legislators haven't really responded to it meaningfully in the right ways. At all no. Since March, for sure.
I can't believe we still don't have an essential workers bill of rights. I can't believe it.
So you've gotten me very excited about the fact that Joe and Kamala had proposed this plan on the campaign. And so I'd imagine that this plan requires legislation. Is that accurate?
Yep. I mean, it requires action on the part of Congress. So it can be done through budget reconciliation. But it does need action on the part of Congress and champions in Congress and a real push, a real mandate from people. And so that's what we've been trying to organize. I've been really focused on rallying all the troops, the caregivers, the older people who need care, people who are in need of childcare and long-term care, coming together. We actually have a whole group, a coalition we call the Care Infrastructure Table, where childcare advocates, paid leave advocates, and long-term care advocates are all working together to try to make the caregiving plan a reality.
What is the saying? It's like, we're all either caregivers now, or we'll need a caregiver,
Rosalind Carter.
Or we'll be a caregiver. Yeah, it's like there were like only four categories, I think. It's either you probably know the saying. I just mangled it. Go ahead. Can you?
Well, former First Lady Rosalind Carter, one of our best advocates for family caregivers, she says that there's only four kinds of people in the world. People who are caregivers or will be caregivers, people who need care or will need care. And my addition to that is that usually we're more than one of those categories at any given moment. Most of us are receiving care of some sort and providing it in some way or another. And we have very little support in order to do that. And it's such an important part of our lives. The big breakthrough on caregiving in the COVID crisis, though, is that we used to see caregiving as this like personal individual responsibility. And if you couldn't figure out how to afford childcare or how to manage long-term care for your parent, it's because you failed. You suck. Like you're a bad parent or you're a bad daughter. And what COVID taught us is that this is actually a huge challenge that requires a collective public policy solution.
Yes.
You know, and that COVID
hopefully, COVID hopefully has just put to rest a lot of the bullshit. That's like the only kind of silver lining I can kind of try and take solace in. Because there's been a lot of like, well, it must be your fault. And then now it's like, is it really the bartender's fault that they don't have a job right now? You know, it's like, it doesn't make any sense.
Very well said. Put to rest a lot of the bullshit. I like that.
I hope so. And then I hope we respond appropriately legislatively. It's why I'm here in Georgia. And it's why that you are doing the work you're doing in Georgia to help or your organization. If someone wanted to help you and your work, help organize for caregivers in a more human-centered economy, like what's the place that you would direct them to if they wanted to put time, resources, money?
CareInAction.us. is our URL. That's careinaction.us. And there are volunteer opportunities. You can always donate and support. And we're really well connected in Georgia to all of the organizations who are working on organizing, building power, making change in Georgia year round, and this election in particular and the Senate runoff. And there's a coalition of groups called Georgia Engage that is working on mobilizing voters to make sure that John Ossoff and Reverend Warnock win. And for your API listeners, there's a special Asian American Advocacy Fund. And they have a PAC and they have a brilliant plan to turn out AAPI voters in Georgia for the special elections. And
4.7% of Georgia voters, just let me throw it out there.
Exactly. It's huge. We can really make the difference here. And so if you want to support them, it's Asians for Georgia. They're doing amazing work in our community.
Well, you're doing amazing work for all of us, iGen. Thank you for everything you've done. It's truly inspiring to me to see someone that I have so much in common with that has made the choices and impact that you've made. I find myself to be something of an unintentional activist, I suppose. Like I see myself as a problem solver, and then I realize that the biggest problems are bearing down on us that require an invigorated public sector in a way that it has not been. And so I, you know, ran for president and did a bunch of other things, but you've been doing
small things, but
genuinely still, like it struck me, I was like, well, this is like the only logical way to try and solve this stuff. But you've been doing the work in such like a genuine, selfless human way for decades. I'm so glad that you see opportunities for your work to actually come to fruition in the next number of days and weeks, because we really need you to win. You know, talk about your win when you were 22 or whatever. Like, we need you to win now. like much, much bigger, much more so than even then. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Yes, no. My big slogan for 2020 is winning is self-care. So...
I'll take it. Winning self-care.
Yes, exactly. And look, I really, really appreciate you and all of the ways that you have courageously stepped up and stepped forward. And I mean, the ambition of having big ideas for solving big problems and then doing big things like run for president. I just love it.
Oh, and thank you.
I think it's
awesome.
Thank
you. I appreciate it, iGen.
Yeah.
It's well, thank you. I'm just grateful to my wife every day for putting up with my being gone all that time. And, but thank you. It really means a lot to me coming from someone like you.
Well, more soon. Let's do some stuff together. Let's win Georgia. And thank you for being there. And then, let's do more. Let's win the care agenda. Let's end poverty. Let's
universal family care. Let's do it.
Universal family care. Amazing.
Yeah. I would love to team up with you. Anything I can do to be helpful, for sure. iGen, you're a champion for humanity. That's the way I'd see you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thrilled to be connected.